We're joined by Michael Wilbon, who, as always, is busy, but always in the midst of all the key issues out there. Michael, how are you?
Nick, I'm fine. How are you doing?
Very good. Now, the question is, are you in a rainstorm driving around the Pentagon right now like last time?
No, I am stationary right now. I pulled off in a safe cell spot, I hope, not too far from your old neighborhood growing up, so I better be safe.
Hey, what's your deal with Theo Epstein? You're always giving him crap. What's up with that?
Well, you know what? It's interesting, Nick, and it's not really giving it to him. I make fun of more the Northeastern media obsession with the Yankees and Red Sox, and that's what my poking fun is. It's not really at anything with Red Sox, Yankees. Interestingly enough, I wanted to go on a tour of the great cathedrals of baseball a couple of summers ago, and my wife had never been had never really been a baseball fan growing up in Washington without baseball for a lot of years, as you did also. And we went to Fenway and Yankee Stadium, and people think, well, why did you go? You make fun of these places. I don't make fun of the places. I really try to make fun of the obsession in the Northeast at the expense of everything else that even the organization I work for, the company I work for, ESPN, located in Bristol, Connecticut, they will want you to think that there are no stories worth talking about other than the Yankees and the Sox all summer, and I just thoroughly reject that as a son of the Midwest, Nick. So it's with great fun that I poke fun at the media obsession with the Yankees and the Sox and everybody being a genius who's associated with them, as opposed to the clubs and the people. A-Rod, Alex Rodriguez, saw the humor in some of this once and told me he enjoyed the fact that I took so many shots at the obsession with it, and that's what I try to maintain the focus on. And I need to probably send out apology cards, Nick, now and then to people
who
think I'm making fun of them.
Yeah, you and Tony Kornheiser are going to throw out apologies right and left. I can see that one coming. Listen, before we get to the new commissioner, we talk about Maurice Claret as well. Don't you think some of this obsession would be reduced to, when we talked about commissioner yesterday with Rick Gosselin from the Dallas Morning News, we had a great interview. It seems to me that the NFL is divided in culture from baseball in many ways. One of them, economically, that no team is making more than twice as much as any other team. And then you have these 4-to-1 factors with the Yankees and the Red Sox. What if we reduced it? What if, in the best of all worlds, and you were commissioner, you were able to say that we will find a way that no team will make twice as much, more than twice as much as any other team. That way, at least there is some chance of consistent competitive advantage for all teams.
You know, I don't know if you want to regulate it to that degree. I mean, that seems like it might be a little extreme. I mean, I think you want to foster competition within the member clubs, whatever sport it is. I mean, I don't think that anybody should be socialism to the degree that people don't feel they need to compete, that people feel they need to just take the check they get from the broadcast rights and say, okay, that's it. We're flush now. We don't really have to do anything else other than put a team out there. I wouldn't want to see that in any sport, Nick, but I do think what has worked successfully for the NFL is propping up clubs to the point where they are going to have a running start at being competitive every year. That's why I think we see in the NFL more teams go from 6-10 to 10-6. We don't see that as often as baseball. Yes, we're seeing it with the Detroit Tigers now. We don't see it, though, as often in baseball or in the NBA. It takes teams years to climb in the NBA, 3, 4, 5 years. We've seen that with the Wizards, the Clippers, 20 years. I mean, it just takes forever. In the NFL, there is at least that incentive to be competitive and know you're not going to be in the red.
Okay, well, then let's talk about the issue of the moment. Let's shift gears a bit, and we want to thank Theo Epstein for joining us again as well. You know, it's amazing to me when general managers in the middle of the season can make time, and we were able to get the commissioner of the NBA only because it was the offseason, I think. But let's talk about Maurice Claret. It seems to me, speaking of obsession, that it goes to the heart of the notion that so many athletes cannot separate themselves and their own identity from their careers in sport.
And Nick, he's even sadder because he hadn't even built a career yet. The obsession was there, and I do what I do because I'm obsessed with sports, and I had another obsession, which was sort of storytelling, and I married the two. But he didn't build a career. He didn't work hard enough to build a career. And I don't know if Maurice Claret had the natural talent to play in the NFL. I mean, scouts would have to speak to that. But what we saw as a freshman was this kid thought he was entitled to that career. And you know, I think part of it, as I wrote in the column in the Washington Post this morning, he looked across, you know, 40 miles away, and he looked to, you know, another town in Ohio where LeBron James was his, you know, partner in schoolboy heroics. And the difference in the NBA and the NFL is dramatic, and LeBron James had the talent to go right to, and it was allowed by rule, to go right to the NBA and make $80, $90, $100 million with the endorsement. So Maurice Clarett was not afforded that opportunity, and he failed to realize, in all lack of sophistication, that the NFL is not the NBA. And just because he said, I want to play, did not entitle him to play. And he never was sort of able to gain an equilibrium. And I guess he thought from the time he was 11 or 12 years old, and Pop Warner football in Ohio is an obsession or whatever it's called. It may not be called Pop Warner, but it's an obsession.
It's Big Daddy. It's Big Daddy Warner.
Big Daddy Warner. He thought he was entitled to this career, and he wasn't. And it just seemed, Nick, that in the absence, and we can say this now with some certainty, in the absence of this career, in the absence of the structure that goes along with that career, this kid had nothing. It's sad. And I'm
nothing.
Not. I'm not. Nothing. Nothing. I mean, didn't go to school, didn't go to class, didn't do anything. Really wouldn't work at football if he wanted it handed to him. He wouldn't work. I mean, if you listen to Mike Shanahan yesterday and some of the Denver Broncos players say, hey, this kid didn't want to do it. He had no interest in us reaching out and helping. He just thought from 11 to 12 years old, he was the most naturally gifted guy out there. He could do that all the way up the ladder, and that was not possible. And I think that, you know, so often, and I know you've encountered this hopefully to a lesser degree, but I know in your career you encountered players who thought, I'm naturally gifted, I'm going to make this team, and they didn't make it because they somehow thought they were entitled because they were so gifted at a young age. And, you know, football might have saved Maurice Clarett at one point. It's not going to save him now. Not in the trouble he's mired in now.
And on top of that, the people skills and the arrogance that led to that conflict and the way that he made the people at Ohio State feel betrayed, even if there was some last window for them to have a relationship, he made statements that absolutely destroyed that. And from that point on, it became a downward spiral, even to the point where he now has what I think, and Pete Roby would agree, our friend from the Center for the Study of Sport and Society, he emailed me this morning and said, it's a mental health issue at this point. It's not a logic issue. It is truly a mental health issue. This guy cannot separate completely reality from his own dreams.
And part of the reason, Nick, I think he can't separate is that he never had to really live in reality until he was 19 years old. It was only after scoring the winning touchdown to win a national championship for Ohio State in Arizona in the Fiesta Bowl, it was only then that he had to encounter reality. And the reality was, you can't yet come into the NFL. You got to do some things you don't like. You have to come back for a sophomore year. You have to attend classes and stay eligible. He didn't want to do those things. So at 19 years old, for the first time, he's hit with a reality he just rejects, doesn't want to deal with it. And so, you know, the notion that he can't separate, of course he can't separate because he doesn't even acknowledge it. Where was he going to know reality between the ages of 7 and 19? He never learned anything about reality. And now his reality is, I need money. How do I get it? I'm going to take it from somebody. They're going to put me away. I need to get out of the situation. How do I do it? By force? By threat? At gunpoint? What is it? And so it is a tragically cautionary American tale that, you know, I find it fascinating, but I certainly admit that, and I used to play pickup basketball, be around pickup basketball games with his uncle. And his uncle worried about him. You know, his uncle worried about him while he was setting these records at Ohio State, just worried about the sense of entitlement and what it does to a kid that young.
Well, listen, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we know that we've only got a few minutes left with the man who I believe is the best talk mouth, brain, soul. He's got the whole package. It's Michael Wilbon. We'll be right back with final thoughts on Maurice Clarett and maybe a little bit about the new commissioner on Head Games Radio. Stay with us.
And now, back to Head Games Radio with Nick Lowry. Join the conversation now by calling 800-878-PLAY. That's 800-878-7529.
His election took the league in a different direction. They had to make a choice between a football guy and a legal mind. And they turned their back on the football guy, even though Jim Finks was the favorite. And this league forevermore changed. It became about dollars and cents more so than the game itself. And Rich McKay was an early name you heard this time around. and he would have been a football guy, but he wasn't even one of the five guys considered for the finals.
That's Rick Goslin for the Dallas Morning News yesterday on our show talking about the new commissioner. So if football is forever a business, is it at least a business that is successful and that people are going to want to watch for the near future? It sure seems that it's really got its act together, and somehow it's injected enough personality, enough roots, enough sort of loyalty and fan enthusiasm that the business is always secondary in the fans' view.
Yeah, it is a business. First of all, it's interesting hearing those comments, Nick. That's what it is. It's business and entertainment first, and then you can bring the sports. There are enough people. You're not going to lose those football talented people. Where else are they going to go? I mean, I guess they could go to the college ranks, Division 1A. But I think the model that the NFL has set up is necessary, and I'm sure they're aware of that. They went away from. I was covering the league when they went away from Jim Fink, and they decided with labor issues being what they were, and with the issues confronting television contracts, collective bargaining agreements, the serious issues that confronted the NFL and that confront all sports leagues now, are those issues first and foremost. They are business and entertainment issues. Then you can deal with the product, and nobody's better at dealing with the product anyway than the NFL. Look at college football right now. They're trying to convince their coaches that the product does not need to last 3 hours and 40 minutes. The NFL tweets and does these sorts of things all the time. The NFL average game is 304. They understand this in a way that even basketball and baseball don't, and the NFL adjusts in a way in which no other sports league doesn't. So I would say that the NFL, the reason that you can have 7.5 million people watch a preseason exhibition, if you will, game on a Sunday night, when only 4.5 million people watch Tiger Woods play on the Buick Open, is because the NFL understands the marriage of sports, entertainment, and business better than any entity out there.
And maybe Roger Goodell will be even better in that regard. As much as Tagliabue understood the necessary legal and governmental and political side that forced the marriage in, for the first time, a reasonably collegial way between labor and management, Roger Goodell seems to have that internship with Roselle early in his career, now with Tagliabue, with the transition in free agency. He's seen the whole picture, so I believe he may potentially be even better.
Well, his skill set is different, and yes, I think that there might be an emphasis on the, there certainly won't be as big an influence, biggest emphasis on, as you mentioned, the governmental side, is because he doesn't have Paul Tagliabue's expertise. That's not where Roger Goodell's expertise lies. But still, you know, the labor agreement can be reopened, I think, Nick, in 2009, if I'm not mistaken. So they're going to have to keep an eye on that. They're going to have to always juggle the television partners in this, and particularly now that the NFL Network is televising games, is Roger going to look to expand that role for the NFL Network? Is this role going to be 3 or 4 times or exponentially larger than it is now as we look 5, 8 years down the road? So he's still got to keep his finger on the pulse of those issues. And I'm sure there are other issues that aren't even on the radar of the rest of us right now that Roger has in his mind. One of the things he sort of got involved in early on, initiated, if you will, that did not work with NFL Europe. You know, it has not been able to expand globally, the NFL and pro football, as a product as much as pro basketball. Certainly not what soccer is. And I know that pro football has designs and ideas beyond just the North American border. How do you do that next? How do you grow the sport internationally? That's one of Roger's passions, or at least it was. How will he attack that? So I think there's a whole set of agenda that we have not necessarily been privy to yet that Roger has. It may not be exactly what Paul Tagliabue was interested in. It may not be exactly what Pete Rozelle was about during his tenure.
Well, last question to you then. To me, as we talked with Rick Goslin yesterday, he talked about the stadiums as one of the great legacies of Tagliabue, 19 stadiums. But California, the three worst stadiums, right? Are
yes,
in California.
By far,
they have
by
had
far.
A tremendous amount of difficulty. How do you see Roger Goodell taking that on? And if he is not successful with that, is that a bad sign for the NFL?
Not necessarily. I wonder about Southern California in particular. Now, there's already talk. I was just out in Northern California recently, Nick. There's already not just talk, but you know, moves afoot to have a new stadium for the 49ers. And I don't know when that comes up for public debate, but it's soon. You know, who knows with the Raiders? I mean, the Raiders is about ownership more than location. Al Davis marching to only the drumbeat that Al Davis marches to. And then San Diego's been able to put a football stadium, a baseball stadium in place. But I don't know about Southern California, which seems to just sort of reject the notion that it has to have pro football. clearly the NFL wants to be in there, but that may be one of the areas of concentration for the NFL now that every other area seems to be quiet. You've got all these new or fabulously renovated stadiums. Maybe California is the area of concentration now for the next, who knows, 5, 8, 10 years, because you really, if you don't have this the sport in a state-of-the-art way conducted in California, I wonder what that sport thinks of itself. On the other hand, the electorate there is different than an electorate and much more involved at times than electorates anywhere else, so that could be, you know, quite a battle for it. It won't be as easy as convincing people of Tennessee or Jacksonville that they need a new stadium.
You think the electorate's involved? You think they're on Quaaludes? I don't know. Sometimes I think that electorate is about as spaced out as you can get.
They can be spaced out but still involved in their own way. I tell you what, they've been so far able to reject the notion that taxpayers should pay for stadiums, unlike, say, Maryland, where like three stadiums went up overnight in suburban D.C. and, of course, in Baltimore, where two went up, that those two were taxpayer-funded. So there's some eastern locations. I mean, this new stadium going up in New York, new Yankees and Mets stadiums, new stadiums for the Meadowlands. They don't quite see these issues the same way in California as they do back east in a lot of situations.
What do you got for us on PTI this afternoon?
Nick, I have no idea. we're working. We're on the fly for this afternoon and tomorrow, as a matter of fact, as we try to work out some guest firestorms where a couple of guests need to, NFL coaches actually perhaps may be with us, but they need to be a little later today to accommodate their practice schedule. So we got more Claret stuff. Certainly, we got a lot of baseball and football camp stuff, and the dog days of August, thankfully, are coming to a close, so we can really get to the sizzling stuff in the next few days.
Well, all I can say is, Michael Wilbon, you are the big dog, buddy. Thanks for joining us, and as always, you're the best. We appreciate it.
Nick, thanks for having me, man. Look forward to talking to you soon.